So what's it like when you suddenly realize the President of the United States is giving a speech about you?
What's at stake is nothing less than the American dream.
Nia Hill Mims, 13-year-old student from the Bronx, is he talking about you?
Yes, he is talking about me because I live the normal life of a child, but I'm getting the education I need to get in order for me to not only go to college but graduate from college and provide for my family when I get older and get a successful job when I need to.
Is that your American dream?
Yes, it is my American dream.
Nia, that sounds pretty real to me, is it?
Yes, it is real.
Education reform. The American dream is no longer pass-fail. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, March 11th, and we are not grading on a curve here at The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. I'm in Boston working with our partners at WGBH. Good morning, Faraya Chidea in New York.
Hey, good morning. I'm in for Adora Udoji, who's on leave with her new baby. I love that Nia is like, I'm going to take care of my family when I'm older. I'm like, wow, you have got it together, girl. Anyway, coming up in this hour, President Obama is talking education. So are we. We'll have a conversation with students, parents, and educators. Plus, we'll visit Northern Ireland to see what locals think of the new violence and the future of peace there. All this and more ahead, but first, headlines.
Bernard Madoff now faces 150 years in prison. He'll plead guilty to all financial fraud charges, and prosecutors say he's not getting a deal. Madoff victim Sharon Lissauer just wants her money back.
I believe Mr. Madoff should go to jail, but my real interest, I don't really care so much that he go to jail, but my real interest is that he disclose where any money is hidden.
Of $65 billion unaccounted for, authorities have only found about $1 billion. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner says the White House is almost done with the plan to deal with bad assets weighing down banks. Treasury Secretary Geithner says the administration will reveal the bank rescue plan in a couple of weeks. President Obama has apparently decided on a drug czar nominee. If confirmed, Seattle Police Chief Gil Kerlikowske will lead a national drug policy. He's been Seattle's top cop since 2000.
And Secretary of State Hillary Clinton hosts her Chinese counterpart today. This was a long-planned visit to build goodwill, but they've got some serious business to talk about now. The Chinese and American militaries are squabbling over an incident on the South China Sea. China says a U.S. mapping ship there was illegal. The U.S. says Chinese sailors harassed it. And several people are dead across South Alabama. Investigators say a gunman killed at least 9 people in different locations before killing himself. Asian markets surged today. Japan's key index leaped nearly 5%. Most other Asian markets also closed higher.
Well, Asia's just following Wall Street's lead. Had the best day in more than 3 months yesterday. The Dow gained nearly 6%. The S&P rose 6.5%. The S&P opens at 719, well above 700. We're talking all this week about the new American dream. You heard that high school student talking about the changes in this country. We want to hear specifically from immigrants, though. What does the American dream mean to you? What did you dream of before you came to the U.S., and what's it like now? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And I'm Farai Chidea, in for Adora Udoji, who is on leave taking care of her new daughter. Yesterday, President Barack Obama called for major changes for American education.
The fourth part of America's education strategy, promoting innovation and excellence in America's schools. One of the places where much of that innovation occurs is in our most effective charter schools. And these are public schools, founded by parents, teachers, and civic or community organizations with broad leeway to innovate
And we're going to find out more about charter schools, including what they are and whether they're really the best places for innovation. With us today, we've got Seth Andrew, the founder of the Democracy Prep Charter School in Harlem, and Pedro Noguera, sociology professor and head of the Metropolitan Center for Urban Education at New York University. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
Seth, just to make things clear, we did say this already, charter schools are public schools, more freedom to set up their own schedules and agenda. So what's yours? What's Democracy Prep?
Well, we're a public charter school in Central Harlem focused on preparing every student for success in the college of their choice and a life of active citizenship. Our students are incredibly hardworking. Our parents are incredibly hardworking. And I think the president's speech demonstrated pretty clearly what public charter schools are all about. They're about accountability and autonomy so that we can innovate for excellence.
Break it down a little bit more for me, because I got the chance to meet a couple of your students. We're going to have them on later in the show. Young minds being reshaped, 7th and 8th grade. But what do they do all day? What makes it different than, you know, their schedule, their focus, different?
You know, when you ask Daniel what it makes it different, he said everything. And the truth is that we have the ability to start our school day earlier. We start at 7:45. Our kids are there until 5:30 in the afternoon. They're in school on Saturdays, going on field trips. This weekend, they're heading to three different colleges. And what they're able to do in that extra time is get ready for college with no excuses and no exceptions. Every one of our kids is on that path. We can have really rigorous academics. We use data in sophisticated ways to give our teachers the feedback they need so they can tailor their instruction to specific kids and not to a general textbook. We are able to have more time on task and prepare for not only state assessments, which are important, of course, but a really rigorous theater program, a really rigorous art program, a debate program that's beating private schools across the city.
Back in some of the things that have been stripped from a lot of public schools.
Exactly. And if you have more time, that's not a trade-off we have to make. We can do both.
Professor Noguera, when you think about the president's speech and the items that he ticked off that he found inspiring or necessary, how important are charter schools? Are they the answer, an answer, not the answer?
Charter schools, at best, are part of the answer, but they certainly aren't the whole answer. The vast majority of kids in this country attend public schools, and unlike charter schools, public schools are required to admit all students, including students with learning disabilities and children who don't speak English. So I think the president needs to be aware of the fact that although charter schools, in many cases, though not all, are really innovative and creative, they do not serve most of America's children. And we need a strategy that's going to address the real challenges facing our public schools, which have to take on children with much greater needs often.
Well, Dr. Noguera and I agree completely that it's part of the answer. It's not the whole answer. Though what is amazing about schools like Democracy Prep is that actually we're serving a disproportionately challenging population. In fact, in New York City, we serve more students with free and reduced lunch than compared to New York State or New York City. We serve more students of color. At Democracy Prep, we actually serve more students with special needs and more students with English language learner needs than does the district. So it's really a function of what charter we're talking about, and I would agree that not all charters are excellent. There's by no means the panacea. However, what becoming a charter has allowed us to do is to serve more kids. The saddest part about being a charter school today is that we have 1,000 kids applying this year for 100 seats. We're going to have 2,500 kids on our waiting list, desperate to get a quality education to fulfill their American dream, and they can't get in because we don't have space to let them grow.
Well, Professor Noguera, let's talk a little bit about the strategy of chartering as a way of meeting the needs of some of the populations that you ticked off down there. Certainly, one of the reasons that charter schools are distinctive is that they aren't all schools. They're a select group of schools that have specific sorts of goals that Seth has eloquently outlined there. But I'm wondering if it's possible to use the charter model to get at some of the questions cognitive challenges, learning challenges for kids with all kinds of other sorts of difficulties. Can you create a charter school that's targeted to individuals who are underserved in the traditional public school system without getting into the sort of segregation sort of nightmare?
Well, you can. You can design charters to serve specific populations, and there are charters like Democracy Prep that are serving high-need kids. But the simple fact is, I mean, it would be like trying to design, trying to solve the healthcare crisis by creating a small number of specialized clinics. The problem is much bigger than that, because most Americans won't go to specialized clinics. And that's the same thing with public education. You can't solve the problems facing public education through a small number of charter schools. We have to ask ourselves, given that we've had charter schools for a while, many of which have been quite innovative, why haven't they led to improvement in public schools now? And I would say it's because schools don't learn from each other in many cases. There's not a lot of conversation among educators in charters as well as in public schools. And because in many cases, the charter schools are serving a different population. That may not be the case with Democracy Prep, but it is the case in many other parts of the country.
Let me ask a question of both of you. In essence, there were some for-profit charter school chains, and then there's also nonprofit charter schools. Professor, let me start with you. What do we know about the state of play with charter school effectiveness? Because I've seen some studies that say that many charter schools don't test better than other public schools. There's certainly ones like, I believe, the KIPP Academies have a very good reputation. How would you rate the movement and how it's doing overall?
It's a mixed bag. New York State does hold charter schools accountable, and there are cases where charters have been taken away. But there are several other states, Florida, Texas, where the charters are not accountable, don't have to take the same kinds of exams that kids in the public schools do, and you have no way of knowing how well they're performing. And I would say that if we're going to use charters as a model, we need to make sure that we are judging them by a similar criteria that we judge public schools. And that's not the case now across the country.
Seth, when you think about it, sounds like New York is getting a bit of praise there from Professor Nogueira. But when you think about the intriguing thing that he said about schools learning from each other, how much do you communicate, not with higher-ups in the school hierarchy, but with schools that are non-charter schools right here in the city?
Well, for us, that's a great question because we actually started off sharing a building with the traditional public school. We're going to be doing it again next year, and we form relationships with those principals. So Principal Wright at PS 197 is an amazing principal, and we work together pretty closely to try and build our program together, so it's sharing very actively. But at Democracy Prep, as an example, we have an open-door policy. That means that literally you can walk in. We welcome your listeners to come by in Harlem to visit us because we want to share. We want this to be a race to the top. We want to give all the best practices that are getting our kids to be the highest-performing school in Central Harlem to share that with others.
Although, Seth, there's also experiences in New York where the charter school occupies a floor of a pre-existing public school, and there's a certain amount of jealousy and competition going on, and that it's not the sort of free flow of information. Pedro whipped my head around with his statement that schools don't learn from each other in practice. Can the federal government facilitate this learning school to school to create a kind of experience, a sort of a broad national support group for best practices in education?
They can, and in some ways they already do. There's a number of schools that the Department of Ed has recognized as high-performing schools, a great school in Boston that's been around for a long time as Roxbury Prep. They've been doing this work in the middle school level. We learned from them. They published reports on them 10 years ago, which I helped use as design to build Democracy Prep in Harlem. So we're learning a lot from best practices of other charter schools and then replicating them not only in public charter schools but in traditional schools as well.
I'm going to ask you, Professor, to give us a quick rundown of one other item that was in the president's address. He talked about lifelong learning. He talked about any number of issues. Give me one other example of something that popped for you during his speech.
Well, I think it's really admirable for the president to focus on education at a time when the economy is in so much trouble. A number of people would say, until you get the economy stabilized, we shouldn't think about anything else. And I think he's right. We have to see reforming education, reforming the schools is being linked to the recovery because we have large parts of this country that are not participating in the economy right now. The only way they will is if they get a better education. I'm concerned, though, about the emphasis on performance pay. I don't see a system that they've devised to ensure that's going to be fair. I think the bigger problem we have is how do we attract highly qualified teachers with proven effectiveness into high-need schools.
Well, thank you so much, Professor. My guests were Professor Pedro Nogueira, head of the Metropolitan Center for Urban Education at New York University, and Seth Andrew, founder of Democracy Prep Charter School in Harlem. We, of course, are talking all this week about the new American dream in light of all the changes that the country's going through. We want to hear from immigrants today. What does the American dream mean to you? Call us 877-8-MY-TAKE or email mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Keep dreaming. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
We're talking all this week about the new American dream in light of all the changes the country is going through.
To me, the American dream is fading due to the lack of common sense in the government and some of my fellow citizens.
Of course, this is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea, sitting in for Adora Udoji, and we want to hear today from immigrants. What does the American dream mean to you if you have come here from another country, whether it was recently or a long time ago? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or email mytake@thetakeaway.org. John?
Big immigrant community up here in Boston, where I am at WGBH, our partners here on The Takeaway, and escalating violence in Northern Ireland. We haven't heard much about that. It's certainly a focus of Irish Americans here in the United States, but we haven't heard much about it since 1998 when the Good Friday Accords brought peace to Northern Ireland. But you probably have heard about two attacks by dissident nationalists in the north since last weekend. One killed two British soldiers, the other killed a policeman. The question on both sides of the Atlantic is this a precursor for something big? Or is it the death throes of radicalism that really is fading out since the Good Friday Accords? Joining us is Kevin Cullen, columnist for the Boston Globe, right here in Boston. And Dan Keenan is the Northern Ireland news editor for the Irish Times newspaper. He joins us from Belfast. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, John.
And Dan Keenan, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. Good to be here.
All right. For both of you, and I'll begin with you, Kevin, the question really is, and the fear, I think, on both sides of the Atlantic is, are these splinter groups attempting to appeal to an underlying tension that's always been there since 1998 and the Good Friday Accords and is likely to escalate? Or is it an attempt to kind of aggregate as many sort of amateur, sort of freelance militants who are happy to come out and get violent for almost any reason and make a show of it? Kevin, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think what we're seeing is probably, you know, one of the benefits of the peace process has been to demilitarize things in the north of Ireland. And this is an attempt to remilitarize it. You're talking about a generation. The two people that were arrested, say, for the shooting of the police officer, one of them was probably an infant when the Good Friday Agreement was, well, not an infant, at least a toddler when the Good Friday Agreement was signed. The other one was a teenager, a young teenager. So, I mean, the history of Anglo-Irish relations is one of actions and reactions. It's provocations and reprisals. The Easter Rising, say, in 1916 would probably have just been seen as like a quixotic act of folly, you know, by wild-eyed Irish revolutionaries. Had the British government not decided to execute most of its leaders, and that reversed Irish public opinion, which had been squarely, you know, against the revolutionaries. And throughout the modern equivalent of the Troubles, which Dan has covered firsthand and which I covered firsthand for many years until it seemed to be over, you know, whether we're talking about Bloody Sunday when 13 Catholic demonstrators were shot to death by British troops or the decision of Margaret Thatcher to allow 10 Republican prisoners to starve themselves to death, it's really been more the British reaction to Irish Republicans which dictates whether what an initial killing of Irish people is an isolated incident or a lip fuse.
Right. Well, Dan Keenan, the reaction here has been Gordon Brown, of course, going right to the site of the Barrack shooting over the weekend and holding talks with all parties in the conflict there, certainly an attempt to calm things down. What do you make of the general feeling on the street in Belfast?
I think you're going to see later on today in this part of the world, John, exactly what that reaction is going to be, because the trade union movement here is organizing a series of rallies right across the north, in which they're calling for ordinary people just to go to town halls and city halls and stand in silence and remember those who died and to make clear that there isn't a level of support for these guys to continue with this type of action. So today is going to tell us a great deal. That's the public side of things. There's the political side of things as well, and it's been fascinating to watch how the parties, the political parties here, most notably the Democratic Unionist Party, which is one half of the power-sharing administration here, and Sinn Féin, which at one stage was the political representatives of the IRA, now a political party very much in their own right, and the other half of the power-sharing administration alongside the DUP, they have been standing shoulder to shoulder on this, insisting that the political path is the way to go and that there ought not to be any room for any Republican paramilitary to try and upset the will of the people and to bring us back to where we once were. So change times indeed here.
So we have a call for a leading Republican politician in Northern Ireland has called on people on both sides of the Irish border to help police catch the gunman. Let's listen to the voice of Martin McGuinness, who's a former member of the IRA, attempting to calm fears there.
What they're doing flies in the face of the hopes and aspirations of all of the people of this country.
So, Kevin Cullen, is this a reminder, whether there's any credibility to these splinter groups or not, that, in fact, what needs to happen is the next political stage of the Good Friday Accords, of the settlement of this political conflict, needs to get moving to prevent this kind of thing from possibly shaking the peace loose?
Yeah, I mean, as Dan mentioned, I think it's the political reaction and the public reaction together that we're going to see. In the bad old days, you know, you would not have seen, obviously, the members of Sinn Féin and members of the DUP standing shoulder to shoulder. I think the reactions have been very interesting. Say, in Parliament the other day, Ian Paisley got up and praised a Catholic priest, Tony Devlin, who had led, there were several congregations that marched to the site after their Sunday services of where the soldiers were killed, and made it clear that the community was against it. Now, Mr. Paisley made it sound as if a Catholic priest had never spoken out against violence before, which is nonsense. They had always been opposed to it at that level. But I think the difference is the warmth and the genuineness of recognizing this. And so you have, which, you know, 10 years ago, not 10 years ago, 3 years ago was unimaginable, right. the prospect of Ian Paisley praising a Catholic priest. So people are going out of their way to show that things have changed.
I think Dan, that's a very valid point, John, if I could come in there. Because, I mean,
please, I want to give you the last word, Dan.
Are we not only seeing changed times on the unionist side of the house, if you like, but that clip that you played from Martin McGuinness, whom you rightly said was a former commander in the IRA up in Derry, had he made those remarks yesterday, 25 or 30 years ago, he would have been shot dead by some of his own colleagues for treachery. That's the size of the change that we're looking into now.
Well, Dan, it's a change that's being tested because of the Good Friday Accords and the violence that's been taking place up there. My guests were Dan Keenan, Northern Ireland news editor for the Irish Times, Kevin Cullen, columnist for the Boston Globe. Thanks to both of you. We're talking all this week about the new American dream in light of all the changes this country is going through. We want to hear from immigrants, and Margaret writes to us, "My parents left Scotland for America 50 years ago in search of a better life. They did so hoping for a better life for their children. I fought hard and struggled to survive. I went to college in my 50s, but for my children, it has been so much better. I was able to send them to college, and they both do the work they enjoy. I'm sure their children will do even better." Tell us your thoughts about the American dream at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And I'm Farai Chidea, sitting in for Adora. We have Femi Oke with the news.
Thank you very much, Farai. Good morning, everybody. The time is 28 minutes to the top of the hour. At least 10 are dead after a South Alabama shooting spree. Authorities still don't know why the gunman did it yesterday. The death toll includes the gunman, who authorities say killed himself after shooting relatives and random strangers. He died after a gunfight with police at a plant where he once worked. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner says that full details of the Obama administration's plan for the nation's economic crisis will be announced within weeks. Geithner told Charlie Rose in an interview yesterday that it will be some time before the nation can dig itself out of the financial crisis.
We start with just a deep mess, and it is our obligation to clean it up and to fix it and make sure, working with the Congress, we are very aggressive and very forceful.
Geithner has faced criticism for being vague as he announced the financial rescue plan. Investors want to know how the government will deal with toxic assets by troubled banks. Top climate scientists warn that sea levels could rise twice as much as previously thought. They presented their findings based on new data at a climate change conference in Copenhagen. That's a look at stories making news this morning. Back to John and Farai.
Well, thanks, Femi. And we have got a whole lot of friends that we brought in today. This is a follow-up on our earlier piece on education in charter schools. There's nothing I like more than talking to students because, you know, I really find younger folks are honest, fresh, and popping. With us today, we have Daniel Clark Jr., 12 years old, and a 7th grader, right?
Yes.
And Nia Hill Mims, 13 and an 8th grader, right?
Yes.
And we also have Nia's mom with us, Catherine Hill, who's also worked in education. So thanks, guys, for coming in.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Good morning.
So we've been talking with your principal about what a charter school is and what you guys do. But I guess, Daniel, I'll start with you. Give me a really specific example of something that you have loved doing at your school, a project that you did or a class that you take, something you love.
Well, one thing that I love doing at my school and that we did at my school is we had Funberry, which is February full of fun. And we call it at the Moxie Prep the best month of the year. And we do everything that we like want to do because we are a family and we do things as a family. And we Funberry is like we get together and our teachers, they do these amazing things for us that other schools don't do, and that is really big in our society.
So Funberry February at Democracy Prep Charter School in Harlem becomes Funberry.
Yes.
Okay. That's what did you do during Funberry that you remember?
During Funberry, we wore different color socks and we got to walk backwards, put our clothes on backwards, and carry around stuffed animals during the duration of Funberry.
So that's all stuff that's the fun stuff. And then I'm sure they work you hard, right, when
yes.
it comes to academics. So give me an example of how someone, Nia, helped you out with a problem that you had trouble figuring out, math problem or writing an assignment. How do teachers, when you can't figure it out, how do the teachers help you figure it out?
My first year at Democracy Prep, I was not on grade level in my math. So the teachers there, they put me in tutoring to help me. And after school help so I can get my good grades that I needed.
So Nia and Daniel, you heard Barack Obama speaking yesterday about how important charter schools are. It sounds like he's counting on you guys to show the way for educational reform in the United States. That's a lot of pressure, Daniel.
Yes, it is a lot of pressure, but President Obama is right about what he's doing. And that we do need these responsibilities because we are a charter school and we have been behind. And we know that charter schools, that we will rise up and be charter schools will be the best that they can be.
That's powerful. And, you know, Mrs. Hill, when I hear that, I just can only imagine what you hear as a mother and as someone who's worked in childhood education. You know, that kind of passion you don't hear from a lot of students.
Yeah, it's amazing how my daughter has progressed since she's come to a Democracy Prep. She's always been a responsible child, but now she's on point. She knows when she has to get up. She knows what time the train leaves. When she gets there, she knows her responsibilities. She knows what her teachers expect of her, and she's just remarkable.
And you guys live in the Bronx, right?
Yes.
So how long's your commute?
About a half an hour on the train and 25 to 35 minutes on the car.
Wow, that's significant. So you have to get up, brush the teeth, get dressed in your uniform. I see that you guys are wearing your uniforms, Democracy Prep Charter School, Harlem, New York, with a little emblem. What's that emblem, Daniel?
Well, this emblem represents Democracy Prep, that we're in Harlem and we're a charter school, and we are different from each other. And what this represents is a book with stars. So this means that we will go to college. This means that we will change the world. This means that we will work hard.
Whoa, listen to that. What do you say we turn Daniel and Nia into educational experts for I and have them address the issue that we talked about earlier in the hour? A lot of people are saying that charter schools aren't the answer because they don't serve most of the students in public schools. How would you tell students who don't have what you have at charter schools, Daniel and Nia, what they can do to improve their own schools? Nia?
You can improve the schools by taking out the bad teachers and replacing them with good teachers. Also, you can reward the teachers that are there and provide them better opportunities with their good teaching and what they have done.
Daniel, what about you?
Well, we can give them more time. Like in Democracy Prep, I go there at 7:45 and I end at 5:30 because of my extracurricular activities. And this is helping me out, and people don't get these kind of choices that they deserve. And with this and our teachers and everything, that this will help us, and these will help their public schools.
Mrs. Hill, you know, a lot of times what I find is that race gets caught up a lot with this. I mean, all of us here are African American, and integration sometimes falters when people say, oh, but I can't live in the city because I can't send my kids to public school. Do you think that a movement like the charter school movement could help mix things up a little bit?
Definitely. Nia attending Democracy Prep has opened her up to different cultures. The Democracy Prep staff is come from many countries and nationalities, and I'm just thrilled that she gets to experience other cultures.
It sounds fantastic, and that was Catherine Hill, mother of Nia Hill Mims, 13 years old and an eighth grader. We also heard from Daniel Clark Jr., 12, and a seventh grader. They both go to Democracy Prep Charter School in Harlem.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. We're going to get an update on the climate science situation regarding global warming. There's an important conference going on in Copenhagen, and Matt McGraw joins us from the BBC in Copenhagen. And Matt, first of all, because you're the environment correspondent for the BBC, you have to go to all of these conferences. And I know that you chase bee colonies around California as well to figure out what's going on with all the species on our planet. As you look at these scientists at this conference, how do we rate the significance of this event versus all of the events? And how do you put in context the fact that the Obama administration doesn't seem to have a representative at this scientific conference in Copenhagen?
Yes, John, very much another month, another science conference. It's difficult, as you can imagine, to separate them all out. But this one, I think, is particularly significant. You've got 2,500 scientists here from all over the world, from about 80 countries. They're intent on updating the work of the IPCC, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which reported a couple of years ago. Its very significant report suggested that climate change was real, was happening, was unequivocal, and was man-made. But since then, these scientists believe that things have changed and are changing rapidly in the world, and they want the political leaders, including the United States, to be fully informed of the latest science, and that's why they're here. They're putting together the latest snapshot, if you like, of what's happening in the world, so that when the political negotiators come here to the same city of Copenhagen in December, they will be able to have the latest stuff at their fingertips, if you like, to be able to make decisions for the future.
What is hoped for the December conference? And I guess I should ask you, what's the scientific headline at the Copenhagen conference today? And what's the political headline? And they're very distinct phenomena.
And indeed they are. One of the scientific headlines we've had here has been about sea level rise, which is something that affects, you know, hundreds of millions of people around the world. The IPCC was criticized a little bit because in its projections 2 years ago, it said sea level rise around the world would rise by about 59 centimeters, and many people thought that was too low. We have updated the figures here. They say it will now be over a meter over the next century. Now, a meter may not sound like an awful lot to you and me, but the projections are pretty solid, and they say that, you know, in New York City, for instance, a meter over sea level rise, it would change the situation of massive storm surges, which are now a one in a century event, to one every 3 years. And that's when you get the subways flooding, when you get that type of flooding. So if we go up to a meter, you could have that kind of event in New York once every 3 years, as opposed to once every century. So that's kind of a real indicator of the kind of seriousness of this type of research. Politically, it's far more difficult because there are no politicians here. This is the scientists operating on their own, if you like, unfettered, free, running around the place, able to say what they really think. So there's, an absence of a political governance here, and the scientists hope to be able to get to a point in the next day or so where they can put together a strong message, send it to the politicians and say, look, this is what we really think, this is what we really know.
Well, what then, in the few seconds that we have, Matt McGraw, what is the chance that the scientists are going to be able to hold politicians to the level of urgency we've seen over the last 18 months? Because certainly the world has changed economically, and politicians may not be in a mood to take this up.
I think you hit the nail on the head there, John. The mood has definitely changed. The mood has changed here among the scientists as well. As opposed to making arguments based on reason, the word I hear the most of here is hope. We hope we can keep temperatures to 2 degrees. We hope we can convince the politicians. And hope really isn't a very scientific concept.
No, indeed. And neither is politics. Matt McGraw, environment correspondent for the BBC, with an update on climate change from a scientific perspective. Conference going on in Copenhagen. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Well, Lady Liberty in New York Harbor still beckons to everyone in the world, but do immigrants think the American dream, in light of today's events, is still alive and well?
Hi, my name is Jack. I'm from New York City. The American dream to me is to be able to go back to my home country.
More American dreams in a moment from an immigrant perspective, but first headlines from Femi Oke.
Good morning. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The former Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz has been sentenced to 15 years in prison for crimes against humanity. At his trial in Baghdad, he was convicted on charges connected with the executions in 1992 of more than 40 merchants who'd been accused of profiteering. Two of Saddam Hussein's half-brothers were sentenced to death for their involvement in the killings of the traders. A gunman has opened fire at a high school near Stuttgart in southern Germany, killing at least 11 people, including students, and injuring others before fleeing the scene. Earlier, Kevin Latzel, who's a reporter from the Stuttgart Journal, described the scene at the school after the shooting.
Oh, it's very horrible. There's a lot of hectic, and the parents are crying, the pupils are crying, and a lot of police is there, and nobody knows really what happened.
Now, in this last hour, we have got reports in that the 17-year-old suspected gunman has been found and shot dead by police. Back at home, another shooting tragedy. At least 10 are dead after a South Alabama shooting spree. Authorities still don't know why the gunman did the shootings yesterday, and the death toll includes the gunman, who authorities say killed himself after shooting relatives and random strangers. That's a look at big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. Well, Americans, keep dreaming, won't you?
I have a dream.
What's happening to us?
The American dream.
A better way of life.
The great American
dream.
Don't tell me you don't know what that is. Okay, well, it's actually quite all right if you don't.
My piece of the American dream.
What everybody wants as they start out.
Securing your portion of the American dream.
In my American dream, the people do make a difference.
Is the American Dream an exclusively American franchise? Immigrants have been talking about this all this morning on The Takeaway at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And joining us with something more of a global perspective of the idea of the American Dream is Edward Miguel, professor of economics at UC Berkeley and author of Economic Gangsters, Corruption, Violence, and the Poverty of Nations. He co-wrote the book with economist Raymond Fisman. Professor Miguel, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Now, the American dream, if we think about it, it's kind of a twofold question. Number one, we've got this enormous recession going on right now. And I'm wondering if off the top of your head, you can think of how the American dream is being transformed for people around the world who look to America, even in these times.
Well, the recession's important in a number of different ways. People in other countries admire the U.S. in many ways, but they also sell us a lot of stuff. And when the U.S. economy is doing well, when we're booming, when there's a housing construction boom, people that sell us timber or copper or other metals have a big market. And when the U.S. economy is in recession, as it is now, demand for all those products falls, and that can lead to recession in other countries. We're just such a big economy. We're the biggest economy in the world by far. That when we're on the down and out, other parts of the world suffer, and that's going on right now.
And that affects immigration patterns and the inclination of people to come to the United States to experience it. It's less attractive during times of recession. You know, the other experience that's interesting to me, which you've written a lot about, is that the American dream seems to be a narrowing of a broad sense of you can escape, you know, the hotbed of Napoleonic Europe in the 1800s and go abroad to make your fortune in all kinds of places. The U.S. was just one. There was Canada. There was South America. How has the notion of seeking your fortune across the sea changed over time?
It's really interesting. You know, where I live in San Francisco, in my neighborhood, I live in the Mission District. There's a very large Mexican and Central American population of immigrants, and there are a lot of day laborers in this neighborhood. And, you know, last year in the morning, you would see hundreds of these, usually men, Mexican or Central American men, looking for work in construction, in gardening, in moving for the day. So by noon, there wouldn't be anybody left, to get these jobs. They would have all been picked up for work. Today, these same men are standing around all day looking for jobs because the economy's in recession. There aren't any more construction sites here in San Francisco, basically. So there aren't jobs for these guys. So the stories we're hearing here in California is that hundreds of thousands of Mexican-American immigrants, Central American immigrants, are going back home. So it's a real reversal of that notion you just talked about. It's very striking, as far as we could all remember for, hundreds of years now, we've been such a magnet for immigrants. We have the jobs, we have the freedom, we have the opportunity in this country. And now all of a sudden, it's in reverse. So it's a very striking time right now.
Professor, I'm wondering, you come from a family of immigrants. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about your family, and also what lessons did they teach you about how to view America as an asset, as a danger, or both?
That's interesting. My dad comes from South America, from Uruguay, and my mom is from Eastern Europe in Poland. They both came, I guess, for a combination of reasons, some economic and some political reasons. So, both for political freedom and also economic opportunity. Certainly the lessons I heard, talking to my mom came to this country without knowing a word of English, without, having a profession or anything. And, she always taught me that in America you can do anything. I mean, it sounds so cliche, but that was literally what I was told around the dinner table. My granddad, who also immigrated over, will always wear an American flag pin because he's just so excited about this country and the opportunities it gave our family. So the American dream sort of lives in my family. I see it as my family as the embodiment of it in some ways. My mom didn't speak a word of English, came here very poor, and her son can, go to Harvard. It's or achieve whatever he wants to achieve. So I definitely was brought up to be incredibly proud to be in this country and feel very lucky to be in this country. Now, these days, you don't see the Polish immigrants coming over as much as you did before. Poland's a lot better off than it was. In fact, I was just reading an article the other day about how the Polish-American newspapers in New York City, I'm from the New York area, are shutting down because the community is kind of, you know, disappearing. And as I mentioned, out here in California, there's this sort of reverse migration back to Mexico. So,
well, it's the Polish dream. It's the Polish dream. And the Uruguayan dream. Edward Miguel, give me some advice. What Uruguayan condiment do you put on Polish food?
we would just sit on opposite sides of the table. It'd be the Polish food on one side and the Uruguayan food on the other.
So is it the case that maybe the American dream is less relevant to the rest of the world now and more about Americans coming to grips with their own identity?
You know, I don't know exactly where the U.S. is going. I hope that the U.S. economy bounces back. There are a lot of changes in Washington right now, and I think that holds out hope that things will get better. The stimulus plan was certainly designed to try to kickstart the economy. And, you know, if the U.S. economy roars back at 4, 5, 6% growth in the next couple years, we may be telling a different story. But,
right. But
we don't really know where we're going. And other societies that have been very prosperous and rich and powerful haven't always stayed that day. So, you know, there's an example from South America. The country of Argentina 100 years ago was extremely rich. Argentina 100 years ago was as rich as Canada. And as late as the 1950s, Argentina was lending money to European countries like Spain or Italy because they were just so much richer than those countries. And, you know, due to a combination of bad economic policy and trade protectionism, political instability, Argentina is a pretty middling country right now. They're not a very prosperous country. So I'm not saying the U.S. is necessarily going to fall that far, but we have to be aware that if we make the wrong choices, we may not always be the powerhouse that
right.
we are, and the American dream may not live on.
Well, a reversal or a resurgence, that's really the choice. And in some sense, all eyes are on Barack Obama. In some ways, he's the embodiment of what's next in the American dream. Edward Miguel, professor of economics at UC Berkeley, author of Economic Gangsters, Corruption, Violence, and the Poverty of Nations. Thanks so much for being with us.
And we're talking all this week about the new American dream. We want to hear specifically from immigrants.
Yeah, my name is Sam. I'm calling from Roseville, Michigan. I'd like to share the opinion about the American dream. I'm an immigrant to this country. I'm consider myself a new Arab American. Democracy is the most important thing to me. This is the dream I'm looking for.
I have found, interestingly, that most immigrants that I have met love it here. People that seem to not be happy here seem to be Americans. Not quite sure why we are all so critical.
What do you think, John?
We've got some dreamers on our program. I love that. It's really interesting to hear those voices.
Very important. And we want to hear more. Call us, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. I am Farai Chidea, and John Hockenberry is at our WGBH studio in Boston. This is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
We asked you for a definition of the new American dream. Apparently, there are about 300 million of them.
Hey, this is Kelly from Oklahoma. I am hoping that the American dream will shift to what it should be, to be a good member of your family, to love your brother, your mother, your friends, and take care of those around you and in your community.
Hey, this is Michelle from Tulsa, Oklahoma. I would say that my idea of the American dream is raising happy, healthy kids and having some time to have dinner with my husband every once in a while.
Works for me. The American dream, deferred, attained, explored. All this week on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, March 11th. I'm John Hockenberry in Boston today, hanging with our partners at WGBH. Farai?
Hey, John. I'm Farai Chidea, and for Adora Udoji, who's spending time with her new, no doubt, adorable baby. Coming up this hour, we'll explore whether a small shift in U.S. policy in Cuba could lead to wider changes. Plus, we'll tell you about Michelle Obama's new mission, all this and more ahead. But first, headlines.
New plan for the financial sector? We're working on it, says Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, who spoke on Charlie Rose.
We start with just a deep mess, and it is our obligation to clean it up and to fix it and make sure, working with the Congress, we are very aggressive and very forceful.
Secretary Geithner says the details of the bank rescue plan will be revealed in a couple of weeks. No deal for Bernard Madoff. He was in court yesterday for what was supposed to be a routine hearing, but it turned into a news event once it was revealed he will plead guilty without a plea deal with prosecutors. He faces a sentence of up to 150 years. Congress has passed a bill to ease travel restrictions for Americans going to Cuba. Don't put in your cigar and rum orders yet, though. The move doesn't lift long-standing trade or travel embargo restrictions. It just makes it a little easier for Cuban Americans to visit relatives, essentially rolling back stricter Bush administration rules.
And Secretary of State Hillary Clinton hosts her Chinese counterpart this afternoon. It was supposed to be a routine goodwill visit, but after a weekend clash on the high seas, the top diplomats have extra work to do. China says a U.S. mapping ship was operating illegally on the South China Sea. The U.S. says Chinese sailors harassed the craft. President Obama is blasting Sudan for kicking out aid groups. The Sudanese government expelled relief workers after the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Sudan's president. The White House and UN want humanitarian groups back to help the millions of people in need there. And the administration is ready to make a new hire. The White House is set to nominate Gil Kerkowski as drug czar. He has dealt with the drug problem as a Seattle police chief and as a parent. His stepson had run-ins with the law on drug charges. And Asian markets surged today. Japan's key index leapt nearly 5%. Most other Asian markets closed higher.
Asia followed the suit of Wall Street. It had the best day in more than 3 months. The Dow gained nearly 6%. The S&P 6.5%. The S&P opens in about 30 minutes at 7:19.
We're talking all this week about the new American dream in light of the changes the country's going through.
Good morning. Paul from Queens here. My American dream is a loaf of bread and a roof overhead.
Sounds good. Call us. Give us yours. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry up at our partners WGBH in Boston just for the day. And Farai Chidea is holding the fort down in New York at WNYC. Good morning, Farai.
How are you?
Great. And, you know, unbelievable anticipation. Bernie Madoff shows up in court. And imagine if you were one of Madoff's victims and could actually talk to him. What would you say?
I believe Mr. Madoff should go to jail, but my real interest, I don't, you know, to be honest, I don't really care so much that he go to jail, but my real interest is that he disclose where any money is hidden.
Madoff victims want him to show them the money, and the money apparently is as much as $65 billion, way above the $50 billion that we originally learned. But Bernard Madoff will likely plead guilty tomorrow to the criminal charges that federal prosecutors had filed against him, and that guilty plea could yield a prison sentence of 150 years, which would be a life term for the 70-year-old financier and who's confessed to the biggest Ponzi scheme in world financial history. Diana Enriquez, New York Times senior financial writer, joins us in the studio down there in New York. I'm jealous. I wish I could be there with you. Diana, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John. I wish you were here, too.
Well, anyway, this is a juicy story. It's a sad story. It's got everything. But there will be no trial of the century. That's what we learned yesterday, right?
That's true. Actually, Mr. Madoff has had very little leverage in this case from day one. I mean, when you confess to the FBI agents who arrest you, it's really a little hard to backtrack into a plea of innocence and a day in court. So Thursday, his guilty plea will be the penultimate step. I mean, this is the next to the last go-round. He will plead guilty to the 11 felony counts that the government has already produced against him. And then in a couple of months, as you know, John, there will be a sentencing hearing where he will be sentenced. And as you say, 150 years. He actually had maxed out at a life prison exposure, even with the single count that had been lodged against him before, because the crime was so big. You get extra points for how much money was involved. And it had involved so many people, you get extra points for how many people were involved. And so he was at a life prison exposure the day he walked out of his apartment in handcuffs.
Wow. Extra points, in a sense. Well, you know, we heard from the victim there at the top the issue that, you know, okay, fine, so he goes to jail. I want my money back. Clearly the priority, or clearly when Bernie Madoff did go to the FBI, he knew what he was getting into. The victims really didn't. Is there any indication from the hearing yesterday of what strategy the prosecutors might actually pursue to get money out of whatever's left of the Madoff empire?
There is. They're going very aggressively, John. They have indicated in a side letter that you can find on our website, among other places, at thenewyorktimes.com. They have indicated that they are looking for an astonishing $170 billion in forfeited assets. Now, Mr. Madoff's attorneys immediately before they left court yesterday had filed a letter in opposition to that number, saying that they believe that under court decisions and existing law, it wildly overstates the amount of forfeiture that the government is entitled to. But in any case, there's no evidence that there's anything like that amount of money around. But it would enable them to trace the flow of money into everything that Bernie Madoff and potentially his family ever touched or spent.
Diana, the question that is on my mind is, you know, in your story you talk about the numbers, $50 billion that was assumed to be missing and now $65 billion, at least the amount of money that customers were told they had in accounts. But how much of that money was real? Will we ever find out? You know, people were told that a certain amount of money was in their accounts with this fraudulent interest. And then, of course, you know, the Madoffs spending money. But how much money, will we ever know how much money went into the system?
We will, actually. There is a court-appointed trustee who has the bank accounts. He's got the bank records and has a staff that is reverse engineering the cash flow, if you will, through the Madoff firms, not just this phony investment fund, but the supposedly legitimate business as well. So we will know how much cash came in and from whom and where it went out. Now, we do know from yesterday's information that he was sloshing a lot of money around. He was sending, you know, $150 million, $250 million to a bank in Europe and then sending it back again to New York, all apparently to give the illusion that he was actually doing some trading when he wasn't. The fact that they knew that they were able to trace those little round trips indicates just how fine a look they've got at his bank records.
Well, you know, in your great story, in describing the technical details of this sloshing around, you kind of put that with this $170 billion revelation from the prosecutors. I mean, you know, some people are sort of doing the math. Well, where are they going to get $170 billion? It seems to me the prosecutors have basically, as a question of evidence, decided to encompass every transaction that was ever made in the Madoff scheme as a way of possibly pulling money from people who actually got their accounts redeemed. I mean, is it conceivable that the lucky people who said, I'm glad I pulled my money out, could actually get their assets subpoenaed to pay victims?
It is possible, John, although I think not to spread terror among so many already traumatized victims. Let's put that in context. The court-appointed trustee who is liquidating the Madoff estate does have the right to, as they say, claw back withdrawals that have been made over a certain period of time, looking back under federal law for 2 years, under New York state law for as much as 6 years. Whether it's two or six is very fact-intensive, but in any event, there is that window that the trustee can go back and explore, looking for withdrawals, redemptions, transfers of money out that he could then claim and return to the pot to distribute pro rata among all the victims. However, let's be realistic here. The trustee is not going to spend the legal time and trouble and expense to go after people of modest means or nonprofits who have already used the money for their worthy activities. That doesn't make any practical sense to spend a lot of money to get a little bit of money. His first targets are clearly going to be big redeemers, big withdrawals in the hundreds of millions of dollars of levels, and there are some of those. We know that from the history of the crime. We know, for example, that a large sovereign wealth fund in the Arab states had a $400 million investment at one point, and when the ceiling came crashing down, it was only about $150 million. So clearly, that money had been redeemed over time and can be clawed back.
What about the human cost? You talk about the individuals, one of them who talked about him gaming the system and someone who says he destroyed and raped so many people. People are incensed and some people have lost their entire life savings. Is there going to be a change, do you think, in how people of means choose to examine the people they invest with?
I think there already has been. I think that's one of the reasons we've seen such a remarkable little tsunami of fraud schemes that have been cracked down on by the SEC. There has been, we refer to it as the scandal du jour in the newsroom, yet another Ponzi scheme, yet another crooked investment advisor. And I think at least part of that is that the victims are saying, wait a minute, what are you doing with my money? Which is a good thing. That's a very healthy outcome for this. But I think what victims really are looking for and are going to be frustrated for a while is a chance to be heard. They've already said that under federal law, as you know, John, they have a right to be heard. The Victims' Rights Act of 2004 gives them a right to be at the plea hearing, to be at the sentencing hearing, and to be heard, although there is a loophole in that law for cases where so many people are involved that it's impractical to let them trot into court. So that's the bind. And people who've contacted me desperately want to be heard. They want to know that the judge has listened to them. And the judge said yesterday at that hearing, now isn't the time. The plea hearing tomorrow is not the opportunity that victims have perhaps been looking for, and they will be asked to look ahead to the sentencing hearing in a couple of months.
But that time will come, and in the meantime, the grim arithmetic of figuring out, as I said at the top, how many nest eggs are on toast here from this terrible scandal. We've already heard some extraordinary passionate pleas from victims. Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel, I know you were there when he sort of almost tearfully addressed a crowd of people at a forum here in New York. Diana Enriquez, New York Times senior financial writer, talking about the Madoff scandal and his day in court. A guilty plea expected today, another day. Thank you, Diana.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry with Faraya Chidea, who's down in New York. I'm up at WGBH in Boston. Hey, Led Zeppelin's back on the road, but does the American dream need to take a new road trip? We want to know from immigrants. What do immigrants think?
Isabel from Gothenburg, New Jersey. We come from Cuba because my grandmother wants us to be here. In Cuba, we have free universidad and free medicine. Here in the United States, the American dream is a nice picture, but not for real.
What are your thoughts? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. So we're talking about Cuba with BBC America's editor Americo Martins, who is an immigrant in the UK. And I asked him, he actually had some ideas about the perception of the American dream and how it's changing for people who look at the U.S. from afar.
I think America is a country that is destined to lead. And we really are hoping, I guess, in most parts of the world, that America will lead us out of this horrible recession. And I really hope, personally, that we are not going to enter into a spiral of protectionism. And I hope America will help against that.
Well, the barriers between the countries are certainly the story of Cuban-American relations. And the United States Senate just voted to lift some restrictions on relations with Cuba imposed by the Bush administration back in 2004. The restrictions are that Cuban Americans can now be allowed to travel to the communist island once a year and send more money to relatives there. The Senate has agreed that restrictions on sending food and medicines to Cuba should also be eased. Americo, is this something that the Congress is doing to appeal to an American constituency? Or does it really amount to unilateral actions on the part of the United States to signal perhaps a whole different approach to Cuba? What's your view?
I think there was high expectations that that would be the case, that America was reaching out to Cuba, if you like. I think Cuba is a much easier target in foreign policy for the U.S. to deal than other countries. But the whole debate in Congress in the last few days just showed how difficult any major change in policy towards Cuba will be because of internal political problems in the U.S., like the lobby, the anti-Cuban lobby in the U.S. It's still very powerful. Lots of people in several places, especially in Latin America, were hoping that Obama would ease even more the restrictions towards Cuba. But basically what happened yesterday was, if you like, a return to the status quo. Everything, the same situation that was in place before George Bush, because George Bush was the one that imposed all these limitations in traveling and sending money to Cuba. But having said all this, I think from the Cuban perspective, this was good news, because obviously Cuba, the economy in Cuba is facing a lot of problems, and any money that the Cuban Americans can send to the relatives will help the economy of the island very much.
Let me just ask one question, and I know Farai wants to ask you a question as well, but do you think, I mean, we've seen an enormous reshuffling in the Cuban government and an apparent return to some sort of conservative ideology or communist conservative ideology of the past that we haven't seen for a while. Is it possible that unilateral acts on the part of the U.S. government are going to have more of an impact on Cuba than any of the Bush administration's saber-rattling ever had?
It is possible. Lots of people are saying that all the changes that Raul Castro implemented last week in Cuba, when he fired 11 ministers, it was a major reshuffle in the government, was in preparation for possible tough talks with the U.S. So basically, Raul Castro, what he did was to put in place people that are very close to him, to have a very united government, in case, some people say, in case there will be any sort of discussions with the U.S., some serious discussions with the U.S. about the embargo. So Raul, he's very different from Fidel Castro in the sense that he's very pragmatic. So lots of people are saying that he was preparing its government for what would happen if a U.S. embargo would be lifted. However, I think it's becoming clearer and clearer that it's going to be very, very difficult for the U.S. to just remove the embargo. They can adopt other measures to ease the relationships with the island, but I think very much short of any lifting of the embargo.
Americo, question in my mind, I went to Cuba once, fantastic trip as part of an NGO delegation, and some of the Cubans I met were concerned that if the U.S.-Cuba relations open up, that American Cubans or Cuban Americans will just come and buy everything because basically they on the ground have no money. What's the relationship between Cubans in Cuba and Cubans in Miami?
You are absolutely right. I went to Cuba last year as well, and I noticed that people are really anxious about any possible change in the relations with the U.S. because they know Cuban Americans in Miami are much richer, and definitely they would go back to the island and would try to buy back property, would try to invest in the country. And the Cubans are very worried about that. I think it will be a big change if that happens. And change makes them very, very nervous. Cubans really want change in the sense of they want to have a better life, they want to have better salaries, they want to have a better standard of living, basically. But they are very anxious that that would not happen if lots of Cuban Americans would go suddenly to the island and start buying things.
Well, dollars cause a shift in power both on the ground in Cuba and possibly in Cuban-American relations. My guest, BBC America's editor Americo Martins, who joined us from London in an interview we conducted earlier this morning. And now, headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much, John. The time is just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. John was just talking about Cuba, and the White House is ready to appoint a special envoy charged with shutting down the Guantanamo Bay detention camp. Senior administration officials say that the veteran diplomat Daniel Freed will get the call. President Obama has ordered Guantanamo to be closed by the end of his first year in office. Police say that they fatally shot a teenager who killed 15 at a German high school today. Earlier, the 17-year-old gunman went on a shooting spree at his former school near Stuttgart in southern Germany. The dead include students and teachers. President Obama is condemning Sudan for expelling foreign aid workers from Darfur. He spoke at the White House after meeting with the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon.
I impressed upon the Secretary General how important it is from our perspective to send a strong, unified international message that it is not acceptable to put that many people's lives at risk.
Sudan expelled workers from several large relief agencies after the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Sudan's president. The ICC says the president is a war criminal for his country's conduct in Darfur. And back here at home at the movies, The Watchmen is doing very well. The movies and theatres are packed out. I was there yesterday for Rai Watchmen Shadea. It's not that good a movie, is it?
I'm coming from the perspective of liking state-of-the-art Bang Bang, so, but there was a lot of breaking bones for me.
Thanks for Rai. That's your news.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, I'm John Hockenberry, and if America is changing, does the American dream change? Today we want to hear specifically from immigrants.
Hi, this is Alan from Holtsville. I'm an immigrant. The American dream for me still means possibilities. America is still a place where people could change their minds. You can't do that everywhere.
Tell us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Keep your American dreams coming, or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Farai?
Yes, I am Farai Chidea, at least for the moment. Who knows? Maybe I'll change my name and Americanize it. Sitting in for Adora, who is on maternity leave. Now, we're going to switch over to a little bit of presidential politics from the female side. President Barack Obama is 50 days into his presidency. He's getting settled in Washington, and the First Lady is also starting to shape her own agenda. agenda for change. Rachel Swarns covers the First Lady for our partner, The New York Times. So let me start out by asking, Michelle Obama, who's my favorite nickname for her is Mickey O, like Jackie O. She's both racially and stylistically changing the vision of what the First Lady is like. But what does she seem to be tackling as her role?
You know, I think she is still sorting that out. And she has done a mix of things, both kind of the traditional ceremonial kinds of things, hostessing, welcoming people into the White House, tasting the food before fancy dinners, as well as, you know, she's a Harvard-educated lawyer and a former hospital executive. She's someone who's really very interested in policy. So she's been talking about carefully about her husband's legislative agenda. And I think she's trying to find the right balance. We're in early days yet.
Well, as a healthcare executive in the past, you know, it seemed to me that the Clinton White House got tarred and feathered for the idea that it was a Clintonian presidency with the First Lady who was a Lady Macbeth type. There was a lot of gender flowing through the political analysis at that time. Do you think that Michelle Obama might be overly cautious about making policy pronouncements because of the way that the Clintons fared?
I think that certainly she and her staff are very cognizant of what happened with Mrs. Clinton. And I think that they seem to be trying to chart, you know, a kind of middle ground, trying to embrace the traditional role while finding some room for policy. I don't know that they would think that they were being too cautious at all, and certainly her approval ratings are through the roof. She's the most popular First Lady at this point, I think over the past 30 years, 28 years,
wow,
for anyone else at this point. So I think they would feel like they're doing exactly what they should be doing right now.
You know, I don't pay attention, Rachel, to the, you know, the hair stuff and the dresses stuff, which is all over the magazines. It's everywhere. And my daughters talk all about it. But I am completely struck by what an utterly authentic and, you know, all business character Michelle Obama is. I mean, and very independent of her husband, and not in the way that Hillary was. I thought Hillary was a politician. Michelle Obama seems to be something else. Is it just me?
You know, she has a very, she is very independent, but she has a very warm, matter-of-fact, down-to-earth, engaging way with people. And she's very straightforward. And I think there's just something about the way that she carries herself. She seems very genuine to people. She seems very sincere, and I think that has some real appeal to people. And at the same time, she's a professional woman who has spent most of her life balancing work and family, and she seems to be very comfortable with that, very comfortable being, you know, mom in chief, as she likes to describe herself, and very comfortable, though, as well, being a thoughtful policy person.
Rachel, she's talked about, you know, championing health and how hard it is to get the kids to eat their vegetables, but she's also been visiting a local soup kitchen.
Yeah.
Collect some fruits and vegetables. Bring by some good, healthy food. You know, we want to make sure that our guests here and across this country are eating nutritious items.
That's her urging people to bring healthy food as opposed to, I guess, just, you know, stale leftover cookies to soup kitchens. But I want to ask you briefly about Jocelyn Frye, who is a law school classmate of Michelle Obama's, who's now Michelle Obama's policy advisor. What does Frye do to help shape the First Lady's agenda?
Jocelyn Frye is a very established and well-known advocate for women and families, and she has spent more than 15 years focusing on really tough hot-button issues, affirmative action, workplace equity, gender issues. She's a very, very serious and substantive person. She also knows Washington, D.C. very well. She's a native of Washington. She grew up here and has been working here for the past 15-odd years. And so she does a number of things. For Mrs. Obama, she brings a very, very serious kind of public policy person into her wing, and we know that these are areas that Michelle Obama cares about deeply. The Obamas also care enormously about trying to integrate themselves into the city, and Jocelyn Frey knows the city, she knows the agency, she knows the players. She provides all of that, and she knows Mrs. Obama very well from law school, so she is a close confident and advisor to the First Lady.
Well, thanks, Rachel. And my guest, Rachel Swarns, covers the First Lady for our partners, The New York Times, and Femi Okeh covers the headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Authorities still don't know what prompted a gunman to go on a shooting spree in South Alabama yesterday. They say he killed at least 9 people before taking his own life. The suspect shot family members and strangers he came across. He killed himself after a gunfight with police at a plant where he once worked. The Obama administration is expected to name its new drug czar at a midday ceremony today. Now, earlier this morning, we called the Seattle Police HQ just to make sure we got his name right. Gil Kulikowski is currently Seattle's police chief. Let me just check at our pronunciation department out there in Boston.
You got it wrong twice.
Twice?
It's Kulikowski, you know? That's your Polish kind of Chicago American accent there, Kulikowski. But, of course, if you're in war, so it would be Kulikowski. It would be Kulikowski, sheriff in Seattle. Very important man.
Drugs, I think I killed his name, too. I just killed it.
All right.
Kulikowski. So
Got it. Kulikowski, the drug czar.
There you go.
His job is changing. It will no longer have cabinet-level status at the White House as it did under George W. Bush's presidency. Kulikowski worked in the Clinton administration Justice Department.
You're going to get letters. You're going to get letters.
Cockney Polish.
You started it.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. The relationship between former Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick of Detroit and his top aide, Christine Beattie, may be over and done, but their text messages just keep giving. On Monday, 682 text messages were released for public consumption, and on Tuesday, $1 million lawsuit was filed by the former mayor's attorney. Some of the texts show Kilpatrick exchanging sexual innuendo with other women. "I wish you could have 2 wives," said one woman. Heh. All right. Well, we're going to take this ball, and instead of running in one direction, we're going to run to the etiquette, netiquette, texticate direction. What should you do? What shouldn't you do on SMS, IM, email, LOL? We've got Onita Jackson, copy editor of the Detroit Free Press. She writes the O Street blog, and she is netiquette savvy. How you doing, sis?
How are you?
So, okay. We all have private moments, but why shouldn't you put them on blast?
Well, isn't it obvious, Farai? I think you either feel you're invincible or you're stupid. I think that whatever method is used, you should assume that the information is going to get out. It doesn't matter whether you're the mayor of the city or a blogger or just sending an email. I always assume that it will be forwarded. My son even asked, as we were having this discussion this morning, why didn't he have his own phone? Now, that's coming from a 15-year-old, but when we live in a culture where information is passed electronically, then you should assume that something might get out, no matter who you are.
What were some of the other problems with how the mayor and his lady friend chose to communicate? I mean, there was the fact that these were not actually this was some government property that he was texting off of, correct?
Yes, certainly. So that information was subpoenaed by the Detroit Free Press under the Freedom of Information Act, but that's the main problem when you are communicating via government-issued devices and all the information that you are exchanging, you might think that it is private, but in essence, it wasn't, as we see by these 6,000 text messages that were released Monday. So certainly, the problem then is what you choose to communicate over electronic devices.
You know, Anita, you know, I talked to a marriage counselor recently who said that all she does is deal mm-hmm. with disputes over text messages.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
I have a friend who found out that her man was creeping through looking at his phone. But, you know, it also reminds me when we talk about the government-issued phone, a lot of us have work-issued phones. Is there something, you know, or certainly work-issued email? Do you need to draw a hard and fast line between your personal email and phone and your work email and phone?
I think most companies have those policies in place.
Which everyone ignores.
And when you choose to ignore it, then understand that communication, when you hit delete, everyone knows this. So when you hit delete, then even if I send you for why an email, someone can retrieve it no matter what I said. So I draw fine lines. There's some things that I don't say at work when you're not supposed to be on those emails anyway, that I say privately. But what we have is a run tell that culture. We have a schadenfreude culture. So if you receive something, if you receive something, well, I need to run tell that. Or
all
in
right.
the case of
Anita, we got to go. Yes. But this, you know, thanks for the tips, and I will try to keep my business out of the streets. Anita Jackson of the O Street Blog, Detroit Free Press.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So what struggling homeowners need maybe is a bully in the courtroom to force banks to renegotiate their mortgage. Would something like that work? Some people in Congress think so. We'll find out the details when Femi Okeh is done with the headlines. Morning, Fem.
Good morning, John. Good morning. All the time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. China's top diplomat is in Washington today to meet with the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. The confrontation in the South China Sea will likely come up. A U.S. mapping ship said it was harassed by Chinese vessels on Sunday. China accused the American ship of operating illegally, and today's meeting was scheduled before the incident on the high seas. President Barack Obama is setting up a White House panel on women's issues. Reports say the president is set to sign an order creating it today, and the panel will make sure the interests of women and girls are heard at the White House. And the move does fall short of the creation of a cabinet-level office on women. Several women's groups have pressed the president for that. In sports, baseball fans following the World Baseball Classic are in shock. The Dominican Republic team have been eliminated, beaten for the second time by the Netherlands. This is a big upset as the Dominicans were favourites. The Dutch manager said that we just played hard and it happened. The Dutch will join Puerto Rico, Venezuela and the US Stars at Miami in a second round group starting on Saturday.
Thanks, Femi. And more news?
I do. I have one more story, actually.
My goodness, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm just going to go to an international story.
You stepped in it for us.
I did. I stepped in news, and it feels warm and comfortable.
Oh. Right. Well, I'm going to go to a big international story on the African continent, and unfortunately a very sad one, a sad day in Zimbabwe. Thousands of people have attended a ceremony in Zimbabwe's capital, Harare, to pay tribute to Susan Tsvangirai. She's the wife of Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai. She was killed in a car crash on Friday in which her husband, Prime Minister Tsvangirai, was injured. Now, at the church service earlier, you heard some of that service just there. President Robert Mugabe described the crash as an act of God, and he also reassured Mr. Tsvangirai of his support. It's the most sincere compliments I've ever heard Robert Mugabe say of Morgan Tsvangirai. Sad day, but it seems to have brought the two sides together in Zimbabwe. And that's a look at your news for I.
Oh, thank you. That was definitely a story, a very changeable situation in Zimbabwe, of course, which I follow. And thanks, Femi. We're talking all this week about the new American dream in light of the changes that this country is going through.
This is John from out in the Detroit area of Michigan. It seems that the American dream nowadays is winning something like American Idol or something like that. Never having to work after not having ever worked.
Well, hey, we're at work right now. So what is the new American dream? Today we want to hear from immigrants specifically. We're going to hear some more folks in a few minutes. Tell us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Well, some Americans' dreams are to get their mortgages renegotiated, and when judges whack banks over the head, do homeowners win in bankruptcy court? Is that possible? The House of Representatives passed a bill allowing bankruptcy judges to change the terms of mortgages to help strapped homeowners avoid foreclosure. The bankruptcy judges cram down the terms of the mortgage, and bankruptcy's always been a bit of a moral stigma, but could it be a relief for homeowners, especially if banks have this or judges have this discretion? Joining us is Katie Porter, associate professor at the University of Iowa College of Law, and she's the daughter of our other guest, Daniel Porter, vice president of Current Brothers Savings Bank in Lansing, Iowa. Katie and Daniel, first of all, I understand that you disagree over what the House of Representatives did, the so-called cram-down law. But Katie, if you could lay it out a bit for us first, then we'll see if you guys can disagree a little bit.
Yeah, the law basically does gives the judges power to modify a home mortgage loan if the debtor, if the person files Chapter 13 bankruptcy. And so the person will need to get an attorney in most instances, pay a filing fee, complete disclosures and schedules, and then be able to propose a plan to the judge to change the terms of the mortgage. And the bill would let judges do up to four different things. They could reduce the amount of principal on the loan, and this is the most controversial part of the bill. They could freeze the interest rate if it's an adjustable rate loan. They could lower the interest rate to a lower interest rate and fix it for the life of the loan. And then last, they could extend the term of the loan. So those are the four potential powers that judges would have to help families who filed bankruptcy and wanted to keep their homes.
So as a banker, Daniel Porter, what's wrong with what your daughter is laying out there?
Well, I always look at it in the opposite perspective. How would the public feel if interest rates were falling on an adjustable rate loan? Over the last 30 years, houses have gone up greatly in value. How would the public feel if we decided that a judge could come in and modify your rate to increase the value of your mortgage or increase your adjustable rate mortgage, because that's what the market did? What's fair one way should be fair the other way.
Hi, it's Farai here, and I'm not sure which one of you would prefer to address this. Let me throw out the scenario. There's something in Florida called the Rocket Docket, which is where people are just thrown through foreclosure process, like, you know, bam, 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 kind of a no-mercy situation. Let me ask you, actually, Katie, I'll start with you, and if you want to chime in, Daniel, what ways are homeowners in distress being treated, and do they have enough time to process what's going on?
I think that's one of the reasons we've always seen hundreds of thousands of homeowners a year come into bankruptcy. That's true even under the current law. And while the new law would probably increase that number, undoubtedly increase that number, one of the reasons we do see homeowners coming into bankruptcy already, and we'd see more, is that there are 50 different state foreclosure systems. Depending on where you live, like where my dad and I live in Iowa, it takes a relatively long time to foreclose. My dad as a lender has to jump through a lot of hoops before he can take someone's home, but that's not true in some other states. In states like Texas, it could be as few as 42 days before somebody's home is gone. That never goes before a judge. It's a non-judicial foreclosure. So I think one of the things with the bankruptcy legislation that could be a positive, it would impose some uniformity on the process. So instead of having a lot of variation in what kind of help you get, there would be a set of even federal rules that would govern foreclosure modifications.
Well, let me just ask you a quick follow-up, Mr. Porter. Have you ever... These rocket dockets are a situation where, like I said, it's really no mercy. It's like, are you up to date on your payments? If not, bye-bye. Have you ever been swayed by a personal story? As someone who makes loans, do you take into account people's personal stories and still take into account your business?
Oh, absolutely. There is no banker, I don't think, especially in community banks like we are, medium-sized $200 to $500 million banks that are personal bankers, that I made the loan 5 years ago, that the person who now cannot pay for his house, it becomes a very personal thing. And there's no banker like me who would not rather have the customer come in, shut the door, work out any possibility whatsoever to avoid the moral stigma, if there still is one, the legal expense, the delay in getting on with the person's life. There's nothing that a banker wouldn't do to work with to avoid all those hassles. And in Iowa, by the way, it takes about 4 months, if everything goes just right, to foreclose on a house. But then if it's your personal residence in Iowa, you have a year's right of redemption. So Iowa bankers and most community bankers in those kind of states would work, go to the wall and work with you to try to avoid that.
Right. Well, by the end of this recession, bankruptcy may be a badge of honor. Everyone's going to be going through it at this point. There's an alarming statistic that I want you to quickly respond to before we go. Most loans that are renegotiated or even in bankruptcy are renegotiated end up in default anyway. Katie, will this bill in the House address that at all? Very quickly.
Right. So the idea is that once we have the judges taking a look at the modifications, we can force the lenders to take a deeper haircut and provide loans that are truly sustainable. We would reduce the rate of failure on modifications. And we would also reduce the rate of failure on bankruptcies by giving families the relief they really need.
Well, we'll see how that works out. My guest, Kate Porter, associate professor at the University of Iowa College of Law, and Katie's father, Daniel Porter, vice president of Current Brothers Savings Bank. Two views on Cramdown. Thanks to both.
And we're talking all this week about the new American dream in light of all the changes the country's going through.
On the American dream, my belief is housing, food, and health care. And I believe the American dream is to follow after the footsteps of my grandfather and my father, to grow into somebody who's strong enough to help my country and to help somebody else grow into somebody strong.
And today we want to hear specifically from immigrants.
My grandfather came here from Hungary and was a migrant worker. He had nothing but he graduated from high school, was taught English and math, started at the Detroit Stamping Company, lived through the Depression, and ended up retiring, as a millionaire.
I'm Farai Chidea with John Hockenberry, who's our partner at WGBH in Boston. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.